Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening if you're in Europe, or if you're in a boggy forest in Sweden with Wilde, it's definitely evening. However, I suspect the sunlight is still fairly strong at your latitude, right?
It is, yeah. It's still summer, so it's we've got a lot of sun, and the nights are still short, but it's not to the extreme where we can't sleep. In June, July, it's ridiculous. You kind of wake up at 2 a.m. and you're getting like proper sun. It's kind of Alaska sunlight coming in. It's really odd. I've been here now 12 years living off grid in the woods, and I'm still not quite used to the light in the summer and the darkness in the winter.
Now, I can imagine that. In Arizona, where today it's merely 115, we really wish that the sun would go down earlier than it does. We have a friend from Alaska who lives with us in the winter. She doesn't think Alaska, southern Alaska, has real winters anymore, so she just as soon be in Scottsdale as in the rain. And every December 21st, she says, yay, we're starting to gain daylight. And every December 21st, I go, we're starting to gain daylight. I'd like to keep it. Well, anyway, we won't go into that. Arizona confuses everyone because of the sun. We don't go on daylight time. We stay on mountain time, but it's the equivalent of Pacific daylight time in the summer. So nobody ever knows what time we're on. But British time is pretty easy to calculate.
It is. British time is easy. Swedish time is quite easy as well. I think it's wonderful and very exotic that you have so many time zones in your country. It's fantastic.
Well, we're not Russia. It could be worse. Yeah, <that's> true. A lot worse, right. Anyway, the reason I brought up Sweden is that Will's basically a British author, even though he's living off the grid in a forest in Sweden. And I have actually read his books for a number of years, but it's only fairly recently, I think, at least, that Atria Books, Emily Bestler's imprint, has begun to publish you here in the United States in a large paperback format. But you do have earlier books that came out in the UK, which we have imported from London. So let's go back, because there are only two books listed in this, Firstborn and The Last Thing to Burn, but you have a larger oeuvre. So tell us about your writing life from the very beginning.
From the very beginning, I'll start off when I was a child living in the UK in the East Midlands. I grew up in a house with no books and no readers. I was the black sheep. I was the strange kid who was always reading. And my mum, bless her, would take me to the local library truck, and I would get out as many books as I could, and she would let me. And because she wasn't a reader, she didn't know much about books, I was reading Stephen King very, very young, which I think is a great apprenticeship for any writer.
And how you looked at it.
True. Yeah, true. But I love that feeling of freedom that I could read this stuff that my friends weren't allowed to read. And I was definitely not allowed to watch the film adaptations for many years to come, but I was allowed to read these books. So I owe libraries everything, and I dedicate this book to libraries and librarians, because without them I wouldn't be a reader. And I think I never expected to be a writer. I never met a writer. Nobody in my family ever did anything that wasn't like a practical job. And then in my mid-30s, after being a lifelong reader, I suddenly thought, maybe I've got a story to tell. And that coincided with my wife and I moving to Sweden, building a cabin in the woods, living a very quiet, old-fashioned life, growing our own food. And then I started reading 3 or 4 times as much as before, and then started that daunting task of trying to query agents. And that took years of rejection, as it does with all writers. And then I was very fortunate, and agents wanted to publish me, and the Tuva Moodysson series was born, which is a very kind of strange Twin Peaks small town mystery series set in Sweden, which will be coming to the US, I think, next year for the first time.
Oh, good. I've read at least one of them. And that's why I was trying to work out your kind of, I don't mean this to be a rude question, but when you moved to Sweden to live off the grid, build a log cabin and grow your own food, did you have any sort of income at all? Or did you just like leap off into the abyss and hope for something good to happen?
So we had been living in London for 15 years in a tiny apartment, tiny overpriced apartment. And we just wanted some space. So we had saved up a little bit of money from our London jobs, moved over here And then I was in the woods working really hard, mending mechanical vintage watches. So I had been doing that for years as a hobby, and then I started doing it semi-professionally. And I'm not a good watchmaker at all, but I am okay with a basic automatic or mechanical watch. Nothing complicated, but I'm okay with the basic stuff. So I did that. I could do that from the woods, and I enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed the contrast of spending a few hours writing a first draft, something that has no limits, that's completely wild, could go in any direction, the terror of that. And then moving over to my watchmaker bench and working on something very minute and specific and binary, like it's either right or it's wrong. I like the contrast between those two things. And I still do it as a hobby now.
Wow. And, you know, did it teach you anything about structure working on watches? Did it carry over into your writing life at all?
That's a great question. I need a year to think about the answer to that question. I'm not sure. Maybe. It certainly gives me perhaps a feel for pacing. I guess I have that feel as a lifelong reader, but that feeling of you need that constant ticking, and you need, when I bring an old watch back to life and restore it, and the mechanism, the escapement starts moving again, it's a wonderful feeling. And you kind of want to do everything you can to make sure that that watch keeps on ticking and that life is still there. And it's kind of the same in a book. I get an angsty feeling if I feel the pace falling off too much. I like breathing in fiction. I like the ups and downs of a narrative. But if the down is too low, then I like any writer, I get a feel for that and I have to fix it.
Well, I cheated before this started by reading an interview you did at the Harrogate Crime Festival, which I have been to, but not for a few years, when apparently you left the woods in Sweden and actually went to Harrogate. I'm assuming you did, because you were up for the Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Award. I love that. I think it's just such a great name. And actually, last time I was there, they gave me one of the great tips of all time, the gentleman who owns Old Theakston. We were, in fact, going to Sweden. We were going back to Heathrow in order to fly to Stockholm in order to take a trip around the Baltic. And he said to me, do not stay at an airport hotel in Heathrow. Instead, take the bus to Eton. It's only like 5 minutes, whereupon you can stay at the Christopher, which is this amazing hotel or, you know, whatever, in Eton. And so we did. And then we toured the college and, you know, did all the rest of it. But I always thought how nice he was, you know, to take the time to tell me something like that. You know, I mean, here's a man who's running a giant company and hosting a crime festival. And yet he was nice enough to pause and do that. So did you have a chance to talk to him?
Yes, I've met him a few times. Like you say, he's a wonderful guy. He's quite a character. He's quite an eccentric character, owning this old brewery that's been in his family for generations in Yorkshire. And that's a great tip that he gave you, to go to Eton and Windsor. There's so much history there, so close to Heathrow. Yeah, he's a character. He gives the same speech every year. I think he's done it for over 20 years now. It's kind of an ongoing joke. But it's wonderful to have patrons like that who want to support the arts and support book events. I'm grateful to him.
No, I think it's wonderful. It certainly has a unique, you know, brand. So did you win the award?
No, I did not. I was a runner-up. I was shortlisted. I'm very lucky to be shortlisted, very happy to be shortlisted. The winner was Mick Herron.
Oh.
And Mick is wonderful and very tough. And he's a good friend and a wonderful writer. And his books are now so well loved because of the TV series, which is great. So I was happy for him to win.
Well, I can see that you would. Mick, actually, pausing right here, Mick and John Sanford, who's one of his fans, and I are going to be talking together on September the 8th about the secret, I'm trying to remember, is it called The Secret Hour? I'm trying to remember the title. Anyway, it's another Slough House, you know, kind of thing. And another great thing, too, he's published by, or when his career, because I loved his books and I always read them, wasn't going well. There was a very small independent publisher called Baskerville, if I remember this right, who took on Mick Herron. And proving that some good deeds are rewarded, they made a fortune off the whole thing. So there you are. But you were with Emily Bessler, who's one of my favorite editors at Atria Books here in the United States. So maybe you'd like us to talk about the last one, having sort of wandered around. And then we'll go back and talk, because he has a very interesting writing process that he might want to discuss, which I cheated by reading his interview at Harrogate. And additionally, you have a very interesting list of authors that have influenced you. That's about as comprehensive a list of authors as I have ever seen. But why don't you talk to us a little bit about the book? And one reason I'm not saying a lot, is if we told you the real point of this book, we would completely ruin it.
So no, absolutely. I'm a little
confused about how to talk about it without any spoilers.
You're right. This is the kind of book that it's very tough for you to talk about at all, and tough for me, but I can introduce it in a few sentences. It's the first book I've ever written where I can talk about it in a few sentences. So the last one, like you said, published by the brilliant Emily Bessler. I'm so fortunate to be published by her. Once a year, I receive this envelope with her edits on paper in the forest. And I trek through the forest a couple of miles to get to my post box, and I take it. And it's just wonderful to think that she's been there in New York by hand writing her notes. And they're always fantastic notes that really help me make the book better. So the last one is a thriller about a woman called Kaz Ripley, who's a 50-year-old cafe owner, coffee house owner in Yorkshire. And she's never really been on a vacation before in her life. And she has a new partner, Pete. They haven't been together for very long, and they decide to go on a cruise, an ocean voyage across to New York. And the first night is fantastic. They go to the restaurant, they go for a walk on deck, they go to the bar for drinks, they have a great time. Then they go back to their cabin. And the next morning she wakes up and Pete is not there beside her. And she checks the balcony, he's not there either. She checks the bathroom, he's not there. She walks out into the corridor and all of the other cabin doors are wedged open and they're all unoccupied. And then she starts running around the ship and she realizes that she is steaming into the mid-Atlantic and she's the only person on board.
That's really terrifying. I have been there. Now, actually, there's a difference between a cruise ship and a liner. So this one, if it's going back and forth, is actually an ocean liner, isn't it? Like the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth and the ill-fated Titanic, whatever, as opposed to a cruise ship. And they're built differently.
Exactly that. Yeah, the shape of the hull is different. They're more pointed. They're not as built up as the cruise ships. Right. And like you say, they're kind of purpose-built to cross quickly in rough seas, cross the oceans. And this book, the ship is the RMS Atlantica, is based roughly on the Queen Mary II.
Right. I was on the Queen Mary I and the Queen Elizabeth I when I was 15 years old and accompanied my grandmother to Europe. It was 1955, therefore giving away my age. And they had been converted back from military use because they were used during the war. They were adapted to troop ships and then they came back. And I'm telling you, I can remember it very clearly. It was unbelievably primitive compared to the Queen Mary II. My mother-in-law dragged us, kicking and screaming, because neither my husband nor I really wanted to go, on the maiden voyage of the Queen Mary II, which I can tell you was right after 9/11. And they sent us with an escort, basically a gunboat, because they were worried that it was such an obvious target. This huge ocean liner, you know, in Cunard, the whole nine yards, they were really worried that there would be some kind of a terrorist attack. And so we went from Florida to the Bahamas, and then we went across to Africa, to Senegal. What is it? Dakar, Senegal. And when we got there, there are 2,500 people on the ship, and everybody wants to get off at once, which doesn't work out super well. And the tourist attraction in Dakar, Senegal, is an island out in the harbor, which was the Arab slave market. And to get there, you have to get on another boat, a ferry, to go out in the harbor. So all 2,500 people, minus three or four, got on the ferry, which had a capacity of 900 people. And I thought, how wonderful we have this escort ship, because as we sink into the harbor in Dakar, we will be rescued by the gunboat. And then anyway, on we went, and it had an engine failure in Southampton. And that's how I found out I never wanted to stay in an airport hotel in Heathrow. We had to wait while they redid all the flights. It's terrible. But the Queen Mary too really was an interesting ship. They also built the Queen Elizabeth too, but they are not cruise ships, as I said. They're adapted for, although they do take them on cruises, but they're quite different if you were to go on one of the other cruise ships, many of which are smaller. So the size of the ship would make a giant difference if you were suddenly finding yourself alone.
It would.
Imagine how you would react if you were alone on this giant ocean liner.
I mean, the thought of it terrified me. I had the idea in February 2020 when we were starting to get scared of COVID and we started to realize this thing was real, this thing was happening. And I, one night as I was falling asleep, it's probably kind of an anxiety dream or an anxiety thought, I saw this vast ship. And from a kind of smooth drone point of view, I went down and I saw from the back of the ship, I went through the internal spaces of the ship, the grill rooms and the lobbies. And I noticed all of a sudden, I got this kind of shivery feeling that it was completely empty, abandoned, kind of Mary Celeste kind of feel. And you're so used to seeing those kind of spaces full of people, teeming with people. And then in the distance, I saw a woman, one woman running away. And I wanted to know what's her story? Is this, you know, what is going on here? And how could this be? And this is the first book my 9-year-old is interested in. He comes to me and he says, "Daddy, that ship, where did all the people go?" And then he'll come a little bit closer and he'll say, "You can tell me."
That's so cute. Well, you can clearly see the Stephen King influence here.
Yes.
I mean, in a way, I thought, you know, that's a really interesting question. When you arrive at that point in the book where she's there and nobody else is there, you do begin to wonder if you're in a Stephen King book. You do begin to wonder if this is going to be a supernatural story. For those of you who don't know about the Mary Celeste, why don't you describe that? Because, you know, I'm so old, I know this story by heart, but many people probably never heard of the Mary Celeste.
It's such an interesting mystery, and it's talked about in the book a little. One of the characters is really interested in the history of it. But yeah, it was effectively a ship that was discovered completely abandoned. The crew had disappeared, but the ship still, I think in the 1800s, the ship still had riches on board. It still had all of the equipment and the whatever they were carrying was still there. It was as if their people had just disappeared. And it's still to this day a mystery what happened to them. There was no sign of foul play or fighting or battling or mutiny. The crew just vanished.
I know, it really is a completely terrifying story, I think. Actually, I will say that I thought the last line of this book was the scariest last line I have read in a really long time. But again, I'm handicapped by not being able to tell you why. So your writing process, did this book, you say that, you know, this kind of vision maybe got you started, but it sounds to me like your writing process is uniquely yours. Do you want to describe it?
Yeah, it's quite unhealthy and I don't recommend it to anybody else. It's probably good that it's unique, but I have an image, quite a visual person. I have an image that's the starting point. And then I normally give myself about 6 months just to think through the story and to visualize the key scenes. So it's all very vague at the beginning. I don't know what the main character is like or what they look like. I see the world through their eyes and it starts to crystallize this idea. And by the end of 6 months, I can normally see the whole story, but I haven't written any notes. And I feel like if I write notes, I might make permanent bad ideas. So I don't make any notes, but I do a lot of research and I do a lot of visualizing, especially as I'm driving and as I'm chopping wood and walking in the woods with my big St. Bernard. And then as soon as I can see it play inside my head, I feel like I have the confidence to start writing. And then I write the first draft in 3 to 5 weeks. That's the unhealthy part. It's almost like an exorcism. I've thought about it so much for 6 months and imagined it so much that it has to burst out at that point. And then it comes out, I write a chapter in the morning, a chapter in the afternoon, every day without a break for 3 to 5 weeks. This one took 5 weeks. And then I'm exhausted. And then I put it away for 2 or 3 months normally. Don't touch it, get a lot of distance from it. And then when I read it again, it's almost like I'm reading someone else's book. Not quite, but it's like I have forgotten a lot of it. And I have enough distance from it that I can then be brutal with the rewriting, which takes me a long time.
And with Emily's help.
Do you very see, much so.
Do
very
you much see that so. Emily, I mean, many people say that, you know, writing is basically rewriting. You know, the final product comes from revision. So at what point do you send it to Emily? Have you revised it yourself and then you send it off?
Yeah, I would feel terrible if I sent her my first draft. I normally do 8 to 12 drafts, something like that. And halfway through that process, my wife will read it. She's my first reader, and then my agent will read it, and then I'll send it to Emily. So I want as much input as I can get from those three people, three very trusted readers. And then I feel like that's the kind of team, that's the collaborative effort. And like you say, Emily is such an experienced editor that I really value her input. But I also value my wife's input. She's very good at picking up on things and inconsistencies.
You've been quite productive since you began writing. So if that's your process, are you able to screen out the next story while you've put away the book for 2 or 3 months and are thinking about it? Or do new ideas start coming to you? And if so, how do you keep them separate?
Well, they normally come at the most inconvenient time.
Sure.
So I'll be writing a first draft and totally immersed in a particular world. And after 2 or 3 weeks in, when I'm so living that time and that place and those characters, I'll start having ideas start kind of edging in, and I'll almost try to push them away for a week or two. But you're right. I mean, some of my books take, I have a book out every year at least, but some of them take 4 or 5 years to write from idea to publication. And I'm happy with that. I think a book takes as long as it needs to take, and you need to rewrite it as many times as you need to rewrite it. And like you say, the rewriting part is so important. That's where a lot of the work comes in. And often I don't even understand the essence of my books until I've rewritten them 8 times. And then suddenly it will come to me, oh my goodness, this is what the book is about.
And this, so book, with this book, did you know how this was going to play out?
In vague terms. I got a feel for some of it, but the ending surprised me. I didn't see that coming until maybe 5 or 6 or 8 chapters before I wrote it. And then I was driving in my car, and suddenly I had this realization of what the ending was, but that wasn't something I'd visualized before.
So you didn't really have any safety net for the thought that you had abandoned this woman on a giant ocean liner in the middle of the North Atlantic without any clue about how it was going to work out?
You make me feel a bit guilty when
no,
you put it like
I'm
that.
No, I'm not trying to make you feel guilty. I'm actually impressed that you had so much confidence that you could do that without having figured it out before you got to that point. That's very impressive.
I think it's honestly, it's not a question of confidence. It's more of a question of I get it very excited, like a kid reading again. I write the first draft. That experience for me is so that I can relive that childhood feeling of walking through the back of the wardrobe and feeling snow under your feet again. That full body immersion feeling that you get often when you're a child reading a book. And it's kind of more difficult to get it as a grown-up, as a cynical grown-up. And that's why I write first drafts. That's why I write books. And that's why I love to read. So when something comes to me, I kind of have to run with it. Like you say, no safety net. I think it's sometimes healthy not to have too much of a safety net. I like to go a little bit outside of my comfort zone with each book.
Narnia, who of us can possibly resist the wardrobe? I always thought, actually, my thing was the Oz books. And the day I actually kind of changed from a child to an adult, I was probably 10, when I realized one day that I was never going to cross the deadly desert and actually meat, you know, Ozma, right on the Hungry Tiger, the whole bit. And I mean, up till then, I was absolutely convinced that, you know, it was going to be possible to do that. And that sort of pushed me prematurely, I think, into the adult world, giving up that, you know, that fantasy. There was a lot of wisdom there. Ozma, in our current age of dictators and so forth, Ozma of Oz recognized that her wand of power was way too dangerous for almost anybody else to wield it, because it could lead to, you know, such abuse and so forth. And yeah, I've thought about that. There was really a lot of wisdom in children's books, you know. I mean, we learn a lot of lessons from C.S. Lewis, or, you know, I don't know if we can call Tolkien a children's book, probably not. The Lord of the Rings.
But it's a similar message, as you were saying, with the, you shouldn't have too much power concentrated in one place. It's a very similar theme. Yeah, I think you're right. The wisdom in children's books is incredible. Right now I read with my son every night before bed, and I'm just blown away by how clear and powerful those books are.
Yeah, they're really young adult fiction. I got acquainted with a lot of it when I took a library, when I was earning my master's in library science, which is today called information science, and read Ursula Le Guin, the Earthsea trilogy. And I remember how absolutely, or Peter Beagle's The Last Unicorn, and books somehow I missed when I was younger, but they still had a magical quality, even in my 30s. Are those the books absolutely you read to your son?
Yeah. I mean, he reads quite widely, and I love the fact that I find him out with my dog reading a book. Even if it's a comic book, I'm very happy. But if it's a book, I'm even happier. And I'll find him in various places in the forest reading, and I'm just delighted when I see that. That's a dream come true, and he loves reading.
Yeah, The Once and Future King, another book I highly recommend. I love that book. It was, you know, I'm wondering... I'm not a rereader. A lot of people like to go, you know, through life, and every 10 years or something, they reread something. I have such an eidetic memory. There's no real point in my doing that. Plus I have, you know, like thousands of books I need to be reading. But I often wonder if rereading it could enrich that original experience, or actually dampen it, you know, because the magic, I think, from the first encounter is almost impossible to replicate. But that's kind of what you're trying to do when you're writing your books, is to replicate that magic, isn't it, when you go back?
I think so, yeah, that purity of feeling. And I see it the way my son reads. He doesn't sit there worrying about an email that he has to reply to, or looking at his phone or glance. He is immersed fully in that story. And I think that's what I'm doing with the last one, trying to do, is just give that full immersive experience, like you feel like you're there. Because as I say, that's kind of what I love as a reader. So that's what I'm trying to do as a writer.
Now, lots of writers are visual, and you seem to be one more than many. You know, I think I've talked to, you know, thousands of writers over the last 33 years. And for some of them, it's kind of like a movie playing in their head. And you seem to fall into that camp, but you must have an extraordinary visual memory if you can in fact create it all in your head before you ever write any of it down, and not lose any of it. How does that work for you?
I don't know, really. It's a difficult thing to try to explain, but I just find that for me, it's a question of terror. And I'm always terrified before I start a first draft that when I'm holding up that imaginary universe, those characters, that it will all come crashing down. And the weight is too much for me to handle, even for 3 or 4 weeks. So if I visualize over and over and over again and consciously revisit those scenes and that setting, and I want to smell, there's a scene in this book where at the beginning of the book, they have this fantastic evening and there's people filling the corridors and dancing and drinking. And then the next day, when Kaz is completely alone with nobody to ask questions to and no phone reception, she's wandering through those same corridors and she can still smell the cologne and the perfumes from the night before, that kind of ghostly feeling. And I sense that. That's not a visual thing, but I sensed what that ship would smell like the day after, and that you still have that memory of those people on board. And I don't know where those things come from. It's just me going over and over again and walking through the ship in my mind as I'm falling asleep, just in the same way as with the Tuva books, I walk through this small town. And with The Last Thing to Burn, I walk through this tiny farmhouse every night before I went to sleep. I just really want to get a feel for what it looks like, what it smells like, what it feels like for the main character.
So if you're wandering around in this world, how rooted are you in your own life? I mean, do you ever find that you're caught by surprise at what you're actually doing in your real life?
No, not so much, I think, because my wife wouldn't let me get too carried away. If I'm picking up my boy from school, I have to focus on that. If I'm washing dishes, I have to do that. But as I'm falling asleep, I think that's a really rich time. After I finish reading, I will give myself in as much time as I have, or as much time as I can allocate to just thinking, just letting my mind wander. It's quite meditative, and think about the next book, think about a particular scene. I enjoy doing that. And then when I'm driving as well, I love that feeling when you're driving, you're using a certain part of your brain to make sure that you notice when there are red lights, even though you don't consciously acknowledge that there's a red light. But then the other part of your brain is free to think things through. And I often, as I'm approaching the start of a first draft, I will start talking in snippets of dialogue in the voice of the characters. And I probably shouldn't admit that, but it's true. And it helps me get into the spirit of the whole thing.
Well, you're fortunate, or maybe it's intentional. You're fortunate that the way you're living doesn't have a lot of everyday noise distractions, such as if you were actually living in London, where it's almost impossible to have any quiet time or any, you know. So the stimulus, I think it's so hard for people today to really become immersed in a book because the distractions, whether it's screen or real life or having new puppies, mine are currently locked up in the back, can really, the intrusion is such that to have a chunk of time when you're actually not distracted by anything and are immersed in the story, it's hard to do. So your living situation obviously enhances your ability to work the way you do.
I think that was part of the decision-making process. We felt a little overwhelmed in London. You get that sense of energy from a big city, which I love, but we wanted to slow things down and have an old-fashioned life. And actually, there's a lot of more work here in terms of clearing ditches and chopping wood constantly. We have to chop a lot of wood to get through a Swedish winter each year. But like you said, there's that space, opportunity to just let your mind wander, which I appreciate. I really value it. And I see it in my son as well. I see that he has quite an old-fashioned childhood because he has no distractions. There's no shops around here. He doesn't see adverts and things. And I quite like that.
So you, when I first read you, you were writing about your Swedish character. How many books in that series did you write?
Five are out at the moment. Five are published. And I'm working on the next one now, which will come out next autumn.
Ah, so you have not. So, I mean, some, writers make a case for writing series, and some writers, particularly people writing domestic suspense, like every book to be itself, because by the time you get to the end, that's really the end of the story. You can't put people through that kind of thing again. I wouldn't imagine that you could reasonably write a sequel to the last one, although maybe you could. But I'm not sure I'd even want to read a sequel to it. I think actually the way it ends is the way it should end. And then we should be left there, kind of like Scarlet. I'll think about that tomorrow when we're going back to Tara. Do you agree, or did you have some other plan?
I agree 100%. That's how it feels for me as well at the moment. Although I am in talks with a bunch of different movie producers and TV producers at the moment about the book, and they have plans and ideas and things that they would like to see going forwards. But I'm not sure. It feels to me like it's done at the moment. It felt like an organic ending.
Well, I can certainly see why movie people would be interested in it. There's a lot we could talk about if we could talk about how this book ends and things going on in the world at the moment, but we can't do that. So tell us a little bit about your Swedish series and your Swedish heroine.
So the two Vermoodisun books are about this small town journalist, a young deaf woman, who is the only full-time reporter in a tiny newspaper office. And like I said, it's quite Twin Peaksy. It's quite odd. It's quite an odd town. There are a bunch of strange characters and strange goings on. But it's a mystery suspense series following this young woman. It's really all about Tuva. And Tuva has a lot of devoted readers who are very protective of her. They really care about her. They're very invested in her. They write to me a lot about her. And interesting things are going on with that as well in terms of TV. So that's exciting at the moment. But it's a series that I love. And I love writing a series book and then a standalone. For me, it's like each one is a palate cleanser for the other. And I learn something from writing both. So I like to go between the two. I enjoy it. I was just saying, I love the familiarity of jumping back into that small town and knowing all of those characters and being able to layer up the textures of that town book on book. And then I love, as you alluded to, the kind of the freedom of a standalone novel where the protagonist does not have to survive the book. Right. I do enjoy the fact that the gloves can come off and I can kind of go in any direction I please. So I love both. I really enjoy both equally.
Well, they're different world building exercises. When you write a series, you know, you build a world in the first one and there's a lot you can't change about it going forward, although you can modify it. But when you're writing a standalone, it's really like writing science fiction and fantasy. You know, it's like creating Narnia with every book, which I think is great for the imagination. So I was looking at this impressive list of authors that have influenced you. And I have to say, it's a really eclectic list. But so Cormac McCarthy, the way he depicts nature in his realistic dialogue, you're going to miss him, aren't you?
Yep, I'm sad. I think he lived a very good life and a good long life. So I'm not heartbroken, but I'm about him, but I'm heartbroken that I won't have any more of his work to read and to learn from. But I think his work is so incredible that I do reread. I'm a rereader and I reread Cormac McCarthy every year. I reread The Road every year. It's my favorite novel. And I always find something new in there that I can learn from.
I see that you said you've read many excellent books recently, but the two that stand out are Children of Men by P.D. James, and then an author that we here absolutely love and wish we would see more of, Winter's Bone by Daniel Woodrell. I think Daniel Woodrell has written some of the most astonishing books, and I keep hoping that he is going to give us a new one. It's been quite a while since he wrote, but a remarkable writer. And maybe a little bit, is he in the Cormac McCarthy vein, do you think, a bit?
Maybe, yeah. They both have that very distinct voice. Mm-hmm. And that year when I gave that interview, I think I read around 100 books, 80 or 100 books, and the Children of Men and Winter's Bone really stood out to me. And really, that's the two books that I really learned from. And yeah, Daniel Woodrell is an incredible writer. And I would love another book from him when he's ready. But in the meantime, I'm really enjoying the S.A. Cosby books. Also very voice driven.
Yeah, and there's another author named David Joy who writes in a similar way. And you might want to take a look at him. And Brian Panowich, who I understand may be having some kind of a book to TV thing if this writer's strike, you know, eventually settles. But there are a number of books in that vein. Patrick, who is not here to talk to you today because he's on vacation, is very much a fan of those particular authors. But I also see that you have named Val McDermid, Colson Whitehead, Sarah Waters, Mariel Spark, love that, Patricia Highsmith, my friend Ian Rankin, we've been together forever, Michael Faber, Ann Cleaves, and Helen MacDonald. I thought H is for Hawk was just a really remarkable book. And she has a new book out with a co-author, which is called Prophet, which is a really interesting vision. I don't know. Have you ever thought about writing with someone? Do you think the fusion of two minds can create something that you could never do on your own?
Possibly, but I couldn't do it. I don't think I could do it. I'm such a solitary weirdo when it comes to writing. I love hiding away, and I relish that sense of writing a first draft in a few weeks, and I'm kind of approaching madness, but not quite reaching it. So when I'm really immersed in this world, whatever world it is, I like the fact that I'm slightly out of control. Like I'm not going to do anything crazy, but I like the fact that I start listening after I finish writing. I start listening to the same song every day, over and over again, at the end of a first draft process. And that's not normal. And I don't do that the rest of the year, but I relish that feeling of, because that's my most creative time of the year. And I don't really want to share it because I think I would be a little embarrassed and I would water it down a little bit. So I think I need to be shut away on my own in the woods.
You know, it's admirable that you understand your own creative process as clearly as you do.
I wouldn't put someone else through it.
Well, there is that, but no, I mean, it's really fascinating when we do events, as you know, we do, like, you know, like 29 this month or whatever it is. It's so often the case that people in the audience want to know about the writing process as if somehow or other knowing it would transfer. And, you know, and I'm constantly reminding people that that it doesn't, that every creative person's process is unique to that person. And oftentimes it seems to me, this will seem like a weird analogy to you, but when I was sharing, I used to wonder why anybody jumped off a very tall structure into a very small cup of water. And I thought, how did they do it the first time? But if you did it the first time, maybe you would, you know, and I think to some degree that carries over, because whatever you did the first time that actually worked to produce a book, I think it's hard for people not to stick to that. You know, I mean, it's almost, I don't know. I maybe there's some superstition in it, but maybe it's like, okay, it worked once. And, you know, therefore it's more likely to work again than if I did something different, like, you know, jumped into a swimming pool instead of the cup of water. But I find most writers repeat their process once they've started. And
that really resonates with me. I that's exactly what I do. And it's because I'm terrified and I find it difficult to write a book. I find it exhilarating, but like a real challenge, because I read so many amazing books. You know, I know that I need to be on the top of my game and really put my heart and my soul into it. I gave an interview to The Guardian a year or two ago where I said that I don't consider myself a particularly intellectual writer. When I'm writing, it's more that I feel my way through a story. And I think the authors that I love, they have that same kind of visceral way, form of storytelling. But the superstition thing, completely. I wrote my debut, Dark Pines, back in 2016 in my son's naps when he was a baby. He was 1 year old, and I had him for a period of time. In Sweden, you split parental leave equally. So I had him for kind of 6 months. And I wrote Dark Pines in his naps, which was 2 hours in the morning, 2.5 hours in the morning, 2.5 hours in the afternoon. And I stick to his nap times. He's 9 years old now. He doesn't nap anymore. He's at school. But I still stick religiously to his nap times. And I'm terrified to change it.
Writing can be a drug of choice. Clearly, you know, you could spend your time smoking something, or you can scare whatever you're doing. Writing. I didn't complete this list, which I really love. Ian Rankin, Michelle Faber, Ann Cleaves, I mentioned, Helen MacDonald, Stephen King, Kazuo Ishiguro, Lisa Jewell, Ian Banks, Kit DeWell, and Otessa Moshfegh. Now, no wonder your writing process is so interesting and your books are, because that list of authors is remarkable. Jacob, why don't you come back? I love this. This is my Shakespeare moment when I call him up, like, you know, in the midsummer.
I should just say thank you to Ian Rankin, who actually quoted on the British version, which was a big career moment for me because I'm such a fan of his work. So that was lovely.
But he's one of the loveliest people. I mean, I've known Ian almost as long as I've had a bookstore, partly because I often tell people this, I was the only person who knew who Ian was at the first major crime conference he came to the United States, and it really had nothing to do with me. But my neighbor and friend, Diana Gabaldone, when she was starting to write Outlander, used to come into the store and ask me to order these weird books from Scotland because Ian wrote under another name before he wrote as Ian Rankin. And I'm trying to remember what it was. It'll come, Jack Harvey. So she would come in and she would order these books, you know, and I would get them from England and the whole bit. And eventually I found out it was Ian. So when I actually met him, in, I don't remember, 1990 or something, you know, I was familiar with all his work and he could hardly believe it. So we've been friends all these years. We gave him a 30th book party here in Scottsdale at the Arizona Biltmore. And I still remember when he wrote to me and he said, "It's my 30th book, Barbara." And he said, "They're doing a party here in England, but they're not doing one in the United States." He said, "So what are we doing?" Here's a clue, if ever, or a cue, rather, if ever there was one. And he gave, I have to tell you, he was interviewed by James Salas, and he gave possibly the most wonderful talk I've ever heard about writing and literature. I mean, there were people, including me, in tears listening to it. It was so remarkable. And unfortunately, I don't think that the audio recording really ever came through like it should have, to my sorrow, because it was, you just had to be there, you know. Mm-hmm. It was almost a magical, mystical experience, you know.
He's very special person, very generous writer.
Yeah, no, very generous too, right? And he's taking an off year this year in order to Christ. So he just like texts from Cromartie. I know, I love it. Jacob, where are you? Come back. There he is. So do we have any questions? We probably left everyone in the dust here with our mic going all over the place.
We sure do. You mentioned that you were approached by some movie television people. Would you like any of your stories to be made into a movie or a TV series? And, you know, everything that goes along with that, all the time that you'd have to spend.
Yeah, for me, it would be a privilege. You know, I would feel very lucky. Things are in development with various books at the moment in different stages, and I find it just very exciting. I, as we talked about, I see the books before I write them. So, to imagine someone else's, some other creative's vision of the book, and me being involved in whatever capacity, is just lovely. I love the idea of a collaboration around a particular character and how it can be adapted and how it can evolve on screen. So I would feel very, very lucky and fortunate, and I'm excited to be involved, and excited about the challenge as well of learning a new skill, learning a new process.
This one asks, do you type your books on a computer or a typewriter, or do you handwrite? I know you're a little old fashioned when it comes to some of these things.
I'm not that old fashioned. I think if I write on a laptop, it's a Compaq from 2011. I bought it when I realized I would be a writer. I realized I would try to be a writer. I bought it in London before I left London. It cost £170, like $200. I still use it now. I've written all my books on it. There's no battery life. I have to have it plugged in all the time. If I don't touch the keys for 15 or 20 minutes, I get a small electric shock, which I love because it keeps me writing, keeps me working. And it's very basic. It doesn't connect to the internet, which I think is a fantastic thing for any writer's laptop. I can truly focus. So yeah, no typewriter. I work on a very old laptop.
Nia asks, the UK and US title and cover for this novel are very different. Do you have any input or preference between the two?
I have input, and I don't have a preference. I think they're both beautiful, and I think they both really complement each other. There's different blues, I think, are lovely. And again, I feel fortunate that I have publishers who are bold and extremely experienced and skilled, and they come up with fantastic covers and the right title for that particular territory. I'm published all over the world now in translation, and it's really interesting to see how different publishers interpret a story and put their spin on a cover and change the title. It's all part of the journey for me, and it's really fascinating. And I enjoy seeing what, it's always slightly terrifying when you get an email from your editor saying, this is the cover, or this is an idea for the cover. You never know how you're going to react. I often give myself a moment before I open that attachment, because I'm very invested in the book at that stage, and I really want the cover to match. And I'm so lucky that these two did. I love both covers, and I think I've had a lot of feedback from readers about both covers, and readers seem to enjoy the covers, and that's the main thing.
You have a Swedish edition there?
That's one of the only territories that I don't have. And that's because my wife is much wiser than I am. And she has said, after a year of being published, she said, we got an offer in Sweden for a translation. And she said, what do you think about not taking the offer and not being published in Sweden, so that we can keep Sweden as home and keep it as quiet life for our son, at least until he's finished school? And you accept offers for the rest of the world and all the other European countries, but maybe we leave Sweden. And I took a while to think it through, and I think she was very wise. And I'm really glad that when I fly back, I fly a lot, like every month or two. And when I come back to Sweden, I know I'm not going to have to do press or interviews. And I can, and my boy is completely anonymous, and it's a real haven. And I'm quite a hermit and quite a shy person. So it's nice to have one country where I can just be completely just the writer in the woods. I like that.
What is your St. Bernard's name?
That's a really good question. His name is Bernie. He is in pounds, he's about 200 pounds. He's a big boy, and he's very friendly, very gentle. But when I meet, occasionally I'll meet people in the forest. I can hike for a full day in any direction from where we live, and we don't see anybody, and we're still in the same forest. But occasionally I'll meet someone who's walking their dog, and I'll often shout ahead and say, can the dogs meet? And they'll say, no. I've never had anybody say yes, because he looks quite imposing, but he's such a gentle dog. He always puts himself at the bottom of the pecking order. If there are other dogs around and there's a tiny little toy dog, he'll put himself behind that dog. He's very gentle.
Is he a Swedish bred dog, or where did you get him?
He's Swedish, yep. He's a short-haired St. Bernard. So he looks more like a Mastiff, really, than a St. Bernard. And he is just a big baby. He's if he needs to be around us all of the time. He's wonderful with my son and his friends. He helps me pulling wood around when I'm chopping wood with a trailer. And he's a great writer's companion. He's often under my desk snoring.
I asked because it sounded as though it would be difficult to travel in.
Yes, I get requests from, especially at Harrogate, saying, could you bring Bernie next year? And I just think, I can't bring Bernie. And if I did, they would need to up their insurance, because I think those wonderful tents they have would just start to collapse if he was there. So he stays here in the woods.
I think it'd be cruel. A dog that size, you know, be almost impossible to, you'd have to like hire your own boat or fly a private plane or something. You can't really cage him or confine him. That would be so hard.
Yeah. I think we would have to drive with a horse box, have him in a horse box.
Yeah, I wouldn't Shetland pony. I know, I was thought
exactly.
About Shetland, that some of those ponies are kind of the size of a large dog.
True. So
you could do that. Anything else, Jacob?
Yeah, Will, you mentioned that your favorite McCarthy novel was The Road. Do you know why? Is there something about the theme of that novel that resonates with you? Or maybe is there something within that you try to incorporate in your own stories?
I think at its heart, that book, you know, it's a post-apocalyptic novel. There's a lot of themes going through that book, but it's really about family and just the love between a parent and a child. And I think all of my books are actually about that. They're all about family relationships deep down. And they're about generational love and generational curses and breaking generational curses. And the road is so incredibly bleak and incredibly beautiful at the same time. I think the way that the dad is, from the very first line, when he says he wakes in the middle of the night in the darkness in the woods and he reaches out for his son, that sums up the whole book. That's what he is about. That's what he's there for, to reach out and make sure his son is okay. And then the way that that progresses through the book and changes so subtly, and then the ending is so devastating with that change of point of view. And instead of it being told from the man's point of view, it's from the boy's point of view. It just gives me shivers now, even thinking about it, because it's something we all live through. We all live through losing family members. And then one day we will be the person being lost and being mourned. And it's our legacy in whatever form is passed down through the next generation. It's just a universal message. And the prose is so beautiful. I think whenever you have something that's very dark, a story that is that dark, the moments of light, those little glimpses of light and beauty and love, the sharing of food, something that simple, when they're very, very hungry, is blows you away. It's so powerful.
Great, that's it.
Wonderful. Well, what a pleasure it is to spend an hour with you. I'm so glad we finally got to meet.
This has been a highlight of my career, Barbara. It's so lovely to meet you and talk to you. And hopefully I can visit in person at some point.
Well, we would love to have you. We've had Ragnar Jonasson from Iceland, whatever. But I have to warn you that summer is not the ideal time to come. try to think of it as a winter vacation. Actually, I'm hoping to come back to Sweden one of these days. One of my very favorite countries to visit. And my husband and I were saying the other day that we regret we've only been to Finland one time, and how much we liked Helsinki, but we didn't really, except for the Lapland part, we don't really know much about Finland. So perhaps we'll get back. You know, we're in that stage where you progress when you get older from go, go, go to slow go. And I don't want to move to no go yet. I'm not there yet. So slow go, I think, might get us there. We'll see. But anyway, yes, we would love to have you come and visit. And I keep thinking I will get to Harrogate again. What I am thinking about doing is going to bloody Scotland in order to see Ian. But since he didn't have a book out this year, it's not clear to me that he will necessarily go. And Val McDermott is a very longtime friend who's now, I think, living her best life in Edinburgh after a somewhat tumultuous life. And I'm happy to see that she's there and happy and productive. So it'd be great to come back. Anyway, thank you. For those of you who have been watching, here we go. The last one by Will Dean, called The Last Passenger in the UK edition. Out right now, highly recommended. So thank you very much. Bye, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.